going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Insight Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight Segment. I'm Harold Fisher.
A level of humanity extended to Tyree by the officers. You just kept waiting for somebody to say, hey, guys, we got him. Let's just calm down.
That's civil rights attorney Ben Crum today with the family of Tyree Nichols in Memphis, Tennessee. He spoke at length about the killing of the 29-year-old unarmed black man by five black police officers. Tonight, the police body cam video and street surveillance video of the incident has been released. Now, we have to warn you, we are editing at this very moment. When we get that video, we are going to bring you some of the sounds of it on the air, and we are going to discuss it with my guests. The sounds of it and our descriptions may be very disturbing and emotionally triggering for some of you. Well, my guests are Makia Green, co-founder of Harriet's Wildest Dreams, a black liberation organization, Nike Sylvain, policy director with the D.C. Justice Lab, and retired D.C. police officer Ronald Hampton. Lines are open. Give us a call right now at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at HFisherWHUR, or you can follow me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Thank you all for joining this important but difficult conversation. I appreciate you joining us. Let me start with you, Makia, because the video has just come out, and as a matter of fact, I am looking at part of it right now. I have not seen all of it, but and I don't know whether or not you had an opportunity, but talk to me about just the feeling that you and the members of your organization, you had a demonstration, a protest earlier today. Talk to me about the feeling right now.
Right. Hey, everyone. Makia from Harriet's Wildest Dreams. My feeling, I feel heartbroken. I myself have not watched the video. I do not plan to watch the video. I mean, within this week alone, there have been two instances of police killing black people from a traffic stop. And so to protect my peace, I will not be watching this video. But I feel heartbroken. But I also feel angry. And I feel like it's okay for black people to feel angry, because this is not normal. This is not how we should have to experience day in and day out. We should not be sitting here waiting for the release of some video that is like a modern-day lynching of our people, like it's a movie.
Mm. You said this is not normal. When you say it's not normal, are you talking about the video itself or the activity of the police officers? Some would argue that this is a terrible, unfortunate normal, because we don't have to go too far back to count the number of black people, unarmed black people, who have been killed by police.
I guess what I mean more is that this is not something that black people deserve. Mm-hmm. It is unfortunately too commonplace across the country and in D.C. We, as an organization, have been advocating for justice for three different people who've been killed by police in D.C. alone this year. The uptick of deaths by police is actually higher since 2020. So I completely agree with you. It is unfortunately incredibly normal, but it is not something that we deserve. It is not something that has to be this way. you know, inherits water streams, we are a community defense hub, and we are inherently abolitionists. We believe that business as usual, the way we have been trying to keep our community safe, we need to be real and recognize that our communities are not any safer with the current system of police and prisons.
I will say to our listeners, as I'm watching this video, and there's been discussion earlier this week about the similarity to the Rodney King video during the early 90s. And I will say, from what I'm seeing, it is causing even my trained journalistic eyes to wince. This is severe. I have the volume down right now, but all of the officers are involved, and the video moves around quite a bit. But there have been several blows to the face of Tyre Nichols. It is really, really heartbreaking. And I will say that even in the very beginning of this video, and I'll ask you about this, you know, Ron, these were part of something called a Scorpion unit, a crime suppression unit. And when they jumped out and pulled Tyre Nichols over, their guns were drawn. They were using foul language. They pulled him out of the car, and you hear him say, "What did I do?" Mm-hmm. Talk to me about crime suppression units, and because this is just bizarre.
Well, first of all, let me send my condolences to the family and to the folk in Memphis. This is crazy. It's crime suppression units. That's why we're fought against them, and there are people in this city that have been fighting against it, and we've been talking about crime suppressing units for a long time because they operate lawlessly. And I don't use that word loosely. They do whatever they want to do. They're out there. They have a mandate, supposedly, that they're supposed to deal with crime and violence in the community, and then they go out there and do it and don't pay attention to the policies and practices, not only of the police department, but you don't have to treat a person inhumane. You don't have to treat a person inhuman in the sense of the kind of things that they've done, the jump-out stuff. And we've had that here, and that behavior and that unit had a reputation in the city that was unbelievable in terms of the action that they would do. And just like they jumped out on Mr. Nichols, they jumped out on black men and boys here in this city because supposedly that was the individuals that was committing crime. Even if they was to stand on the corner doing nothing, they would ride up and jump out on them and all of that. And Mr. Nichols' response was the response from 99% of the young people, black. What did I do? They were just standing there on the corner. And so it's crazy. That's why we worked hard in this city. I worked with several organizations to put all of that to an end, to stop the use of jump-out units. And the police, I remember doing the last police chief, he talked about he eliminated them. Even Lanier said that they didn't have it anymore. But all you had to do was go out to Southeast and stand on some of the corners, and you could see the units, the jump-out units operating. And some mm-hmm. of them wear uniforms, and some of them wear plain clothes.
Nike, the D.C. Justice Lab has really been the tip of the spear when it comes to police reform here in the District of Columbia. And even though this has happened in Memphis, Tennessee, talk to me about what this means to you, your organization, as it relates to trying to move police reform here in the District of Columbia.
Absolutely. Thank you for asking. So I think one of the things that happens is that people think that, for example, in the District of Columbia, we have a diverse police force and it's about half black, and that might protect us, protect our community from this kind of violence. However, diversifying police forces and diversifying the leadership of police forces will not stop the violence. And we've seen that because, like I said, D.C. Police Department, MPD, is half black. We have a black police chief. We have a black mayor. We have even a fairly progressive population, but we still have incredibly racist policing. And there was an independent study that was commissioned by the Office of Police Complaints based on 2019 data from the Narcotics and Special Investigations Division unit, the NSID unit, which houses the unit that we consider jump out units. That includes the gun recovery unit, narcotics enforcement, major case. And out of that study, there were 59 uses of force, and 100% every single use of force by that unit during that time was against a black person.
Do you think it matters that the five officers who have been charged in the killing, the murder of Tyre Nichols, does race matter here? Ben Crump says it doesn't. He said this was about culture, and as a matter of fact, let me play a little bit about what he said regarding that issue.
As much as those five officers killed Tyre Nichols, it was the police culture in America that killed Tyre Nichols.
Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I think that these tragedies only remind us of what we already know, right? This country believes that black people, black life, black humanity are expendable. And this, we see this through policing as much as we see it through all kinds of other systems. And police officers, regardless of race, are trained to behave as though black people are expendable.
Mm-hmm. We are talking about the killing of Tyre Nichols in Memphis, Tennessee on January 7th by five black Memphis police officers. Tyre Nichols was a 29-year-old black man who was stopped during a traffic stop. He was unarmed. The video, the police body cam video, has just been released literally within the last 20 minutes or so. Also, there is other video that has also been released. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Before I go back to Makia, I want to play a little bit of what we've already seen.
Rodney King. In every way, you could hear Mr. Nichols complying with the request. Rodney King was complying with the request. So what was the reason for the beating? What was the reason for the inhumane treatment if he's responding to what you're asking him to do, to get on the ground? And I don't want to say it myself because we see evidence of it every day in terms of how the police treat people when these kind of incidents happen. So it takes you back. The police leaders, police culture in this country haven't really changed from Rodney King. We've seen, I don't even like to use the word reform anymore because reform hasn't worked. If reform is working, we would not have these type of incidents. But reform doesn't go deep enough, because this is, like Crump talked about, this is a foundational cultural issue of the organizations, the institution of policing in this country. And unless you deal with that, you're not going to stop it. And it doesn't sometimes make any difference who the color of the color of the police officer.
Makia, if you can, I want you to react to this next piece of sound from the press conference earlier today. I want your opinion about this.
We want to proclaim that this is the blueprint going forward for any time, any officers, whether they be black or white, will be held accountable.
What do you think about the time that it took from January 7th until this week, when these officers were fired and when they were charged with these crimes? Your thoughts about the speed of that happening compared to what we've seen in the past?
I mean, I think at the end of the day, no amount of, you know, reform is going to end that intentional and incessant terrorizing of black communities, right? And at the end of the day, the justice that we truly deserve and the justice we're really calling for is to save black lives. So the indictment of these four officers are not don't bring Tyree back to his family and doesn't stop future police murders. And so for me, in this moment, when I hear that, I think when we talk about what is the blueprint of what should happen, I want to stop and prevent murders by police instead of, you know, what do we do afterwards? When we look at what's happened in Memphis, but we also look at what's happened in D.C., you know, I'd be remiss not to name the folks that we right now do not have the video footage, right now do not have the names of the people who killed Troy Bullock. We don't have the videos for David Lazarus Wilson or Kevin Hargrave Sherrod. We are still seeking justice for those people. And so any type of indictment doesn't bring them back at the end of the day. And so I agree with the folks on the panel, because it is inherent around policing. The institution is fundamentally built on the state's authority to use violence as they see fit. Yeah. These officers are not accountable to the law, and therefore they do not enforce it.
I need to take a break, but when we come back, we will continue the discussion about the Tyree Nichols incident, the murder of an unarmed black man by five black police officers in Memphis, Tennessee. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm on WHUR. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We'll be back on Sirius XM Channel 141 in just a few seconds.
What I've heard is very horrific. Very horrific.
That is the mother of Tyree Nichols today, talking about the video that has just been released, the video of the beating of the 29-year-old unarmed black man in Memphis, Tennessee on January 7th by five black Memphis police officers, all of them now fired, all of them charged with a laundry list of crimes, including second-degree murder. We're talking about this difficult issue. Again, I want to warn our listeners that the sounds and our descriptions may be very disturbing, emotionally triggering for you ahead, because we are going to share more of what we have heard and seen this evening. My guests are Makia Green, co-founder of Harriet's Wildest Dreams, a black liberation organization, Nike Savane, policy director at the D.C. Justice Lab, and retired D.C. police officer Ron Hampton. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Big J, calling from Maryland. Thanks for calling, Big J. What's on your mind?
Yeah, good afternoon. It's so difficult to listen to that video. I don't know. We don't know how we can have some authority all those senators, all those congressmen, they don't react, they don't say nothing about all those mess police who doesn't have a good training. Just for 30 days or 90 days for training, those supposed to be police officers. They need to go to Europe. They need to see how they're training police over there. They're real professionals. Or police here, they're just built to kill the black community.
Hmm.
We have to be strong.
Yeah.
But I present my condolences to that our sister. We had to pray for her, and we had to pray for entire black community, because that thing will never end. Just Gettysburg, Maryland here.
Yeah.
And we asked the commissioner to investigate in Gettysburg Police Department.
Yeah. Well, Big J, thank you so much for your comments. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We heard from President Biden today. Nike, this is for you. I want your thoughts about this. You have to listen carefully because he was, I believe, outside of his helicopter.
Told her that I was going to be making a case to the Congress and to Pastor George Floyd Act. We should get this under control. I can only do so much in an executive order at the federal level. And the prayer, I was really pleased that she called for no peaceful protest, no violence, no movement at all.
It's my understanding that President Biden spoke with Tyree Nichols' mother earlier today, and he was talking about the George Floyd Policing Act. Like, hey, this is your wheelhouse, policy and the like. Your thoughts about what the president was saying?
My initial reaction is that these kinds of bills solidify the false belief that carceral institutions, including policing, are mostly good and that they just need a few tweaks to operate fairly. However, as we've discussed, you know, at length already this evening, it really is integral to the system of policing to devalue and dehumanize black people. So that's not something that you can fix with this bill. That's not something that will be fixed with this bill, because ultimately the institution of policing remains the same. And this bill actually gives more money to policing as an institution, and it sort of legitimizes or continues to legitimize the institution of policing that is sort of racist at its core.
Yeah. And Harold, let me say this.
Yeah, go ahead.
If respond to the brother's statement, if training was the answer to this, it would stop long, long time ago, because every time one of these incidents happened, we start talking about training and additional training and training. And the fact of the matter is that this isn't a result of a lack of training. This is a result of not fundamentally going deep enough to deal with the culture of the institution and organization that exists. And let me just say this.
But let me ask you, because that's a really, really important point.
Yes, sir.
Black police officers, black driver, black police chief. So, but this is not, as we have seen in other cases, like the George Floyd murder, for example.
Mm-hmm.
This is not black and white. This is black and blue.
Well, it doesn't make any difference.
So, but to explain the culture, you know, what happens? Did these officers just all of a sudden just stop being black and lose their humanity and look at this young man? He could have been their brother, he could have been their friend, he could have been somebody that they played pool with, bowling with, had played basketball with, whatever.
But the institution has convinced him that their actions and behavior is a result of their color, and so color doesn't make a difference. Black police officers, when I served in the National Black Police Association for 23 years as its executive director, this isn't a new issue for black police officers. We've been raising this issue all along. And you can't dispel the history of policing in this country as it relates to the slave and the controlling the slaves and black folk. And it still continues today. It isn't as overt as we would like to see it. But it's there. It's a system, institutional racism that exists in our system, and we haven't changed it. I don't care when we've had black leadership in the police department off and on for some time now. I was there in 78 when we got our first black chief of police. But it was very little that Bertell Jefferson, Maurice Turner, and Ike Footwood could do because the institution, the culture of the institution is what needs to be dealt with. As a matter of fact, and this is it's crazy, but as a result of all of the work that we've been doing for years and the stuff that Nike and all of them been doing, I'm of the opinion that we need to abolish the system and then start all over again. And we need to design it in a way that it's going to serve black people, not victimize black people, but serve black people. Because it already serves white folk. All you got to do is just see the police at work every single day. But that doesn't happen in our black community. And we've been talking about this, Harold, for many years. This isn't a new issue. So what we see here is an example of the institutional, foundational racism that exists in the system. And those black officers are acting it out and carrying out the agenda of the system. So it doesn't make any difference what color the officers are because they get paid. The system pays them to do what it is that the system wants them to do. It's like going in the service and being exposed to basic training. You no longer are an individual. You've been gone. You go to basic training for 30 days. They show you how and train you to be a team member and to do what they tell you to do. And that's the same thing that happens in the police department.
Markia, let me ask you, because we've long heard the term, you can't legislate racism away. You can't legislate prejudice away. But as it relates to this, and I ask again, where is the compassion? Where is the humanity in something like this? And you know, we've heard recently over the past couple of years that police departments are now trying to address the issue about officers intervening. How is it in your mind, Makia, that nobody said while this was happening, hey, wait a minute, this is too much, this is enough, look at what's happening?
Well, because there's no good cop in a racist system. And I think that's what a lot of folks are trying to say, that there is, that the policing in itself must be abolished. And I think the humanity exists in the folks who are trying to build another way of living, right? In when Harry saw the students, we're building a DC safety squad where folks are interested and they're willing to put their energy behind alternatives, right? Having different folks coming out to our community to help us with things like homelessness, having people come out to help us for folks with overdoses, the things that folks are afraid of in our community. I completely believe that policing, police and prisons needs to be abolished, and that we need to invest in harm reduction and invest in our communities, because if we want to keep it real, if you look at D.C., if you look at all of the communities that you might imagine might be the safest are not the communities with more police. They're going to be the communities with more grocery stores, with more resources. The communities that we feel least safe are actually the communities that have the most police in them. So we need to invest in us and really divest from policing.
So I 100% agree with Makia, right? You asked earlier about the race of a cop. Does race play into this? Mm-hmm. And I said I agreed that it didn't, in the sense that the race, I saw a tweet actually this week that I think encompassed it really well and really succinctly by Ellie Mistal that just said, the race of a cop is cop. Mm-hmm. That is their race, right? And the only way race factors into this here is that black people, as we keep saying over and over, are not seen as valued members of the community, right? That's why it's so easy to divest from black communities, black education, grocery stores, black families, and all of that. And that's why at DC Justice Lab, we are fighting to create the kind of community that, you know, we've been describing, is one that actually sees inherent value in everyone, right, that provides support early and often to prevent us from getting to these situations of crisis, to prevent this over-reliance on policing overall. And the only way, really, to decrease the harm that keeps getting committed by the state over and over and over and over is to reduce contact between the state, or cops in specifically, and civilians, right? And in D.C., and in other jurisdictions, that could look like ending jump outs, actually ending jump outs, not ending jump outs by name, but ending the practice of jump outs, transferring nonviolent traffic offenses and enforcement to civilian employees. So you're not having cops with guns on their sides, giving people tickets for speeding, for littering, for things like that, because we see how these minor offenses by Black people result in death sentences, result in street executions over and over and over, regardless of body-worn camera footage, regardless of bystanders watching and pleading, regardless of how many officers are on the scene and should be intervening. And overall, the biggest change that needs to happen is that we need to heavily invest in meeting people's basic needs and in community-based alternatives.
So let me stop you there, because all of that sounds great, but let's be realistic. Because I, in sitting in this position, and I've heard activists say we need to get rid of the police and redo the whole thing, that we need to invest in community, and we need to do all of these other kinds of things. And on the surface, it sounds great. But what do you do about the other people on the street who are committing crimes? I'm not talking about your Tyre Nichols, who, okay, they say that it was, you know, that he was swerving or what. I'm not talking about those folks. I'm talking about the folks that put a gun to the head of a Metro bus driver when he was putting gas in his brand new BMW, his dream car, who was bothering no one. When we are talking about people who, when you know, the grandma on the block asked some folks who are yelling and cursing on her front yard, and she comes out and politely asks them not to do that, and they beat her down, who is going to protect those people, Ron?
The police.
So that's my point, because...
No, but that's not the police that we're talking about. Because you can do both at the same time.
You can deal with
what happens in our community that destroys our community, but you also can reinvest and invest in the kind of things on the front end that prevent the destroy... the destroying of our community, as well as investing in the services. Our community needs mental health attention. We need
I get that, but I don't want to go too far afield. And Makia, can both be done at the same time?
I think so.
I would jump in the sense of every instance of community violence that we can sit here and describe, you know, what happens with that. We have a fully funded police department, and they didn't stop that crime, mm-hmm. right? The fully funded police department is not ending the war on Black women, on Black trans women in our community. It is not ending the thousands of Black girls who are missing right now. So in the sense, activists, we are of the same community. We no longer, you have cops on every block and kids are still getting shot. So what is happening right now, maybe in theory, it feels like, well, this, we just have to have police, right? Because I've lived my whole life with the police the way that they are. But the police are not preventing the crime. And sometimes they're not even showing up afterwards. Many times it's not even getting reported.
So my question is, if that is what you believe, are you suggesting that police do not have a role in the community, in the Black community?
I think that I want to decenter police completely when it comes to solutions for safety.
What does that mean?
Decentering police is saying that I want to focus
on the people in our community that are actually keeping folks safe. Who is the folk on your, who's the person on your block that is actually making sure when kids come home, right? Who are the folks in your church? Who are the folks in your family that are making sure that the children, that folks who have mental health issues, that folks who are using drugs, that folks who are living in poverty make it through? Because we've actually been trying to keep ourselves safe with or without police. And so I think that when we talk about the investment in our community and we talk about decentering police, right now the conversation is constantly about what the police as this idea of, you know, police, this blue race, deserve, where should they go, and it completely takes us away from the fact that our communities are trying to keep ourselves safe, but they are underfunded. They don't have the funds and they don't have the resources. And when they name that, they are gaslit by the same people, the police, around the ways that we're trying to get free. I think of all the work that DC Justice Lab is doing in the city around policy. Our DC police union are often the ones coming against community members who are trying to find a new way to be.
Nike, I asked the question, and I put it as simply as I possibly can. So who do you call when someone breaks into your house? Who do you call when someone breaks into your house and that person looks like you and shoots your partner? How do you address that? I'm trying to really, you know, I agree that these five officers here, this is not an anomaly. These things have happened before. And Ben Crump said earlier, it's going to happen again. But with all of the other things that are happening in our community, when someone damages your car on purpose, who do you call?
I understand that question. I understand the fear. I do. I get it, right? I hear the gunshots in my neighborhood, in my backyard as well. I understand that sort of visceral fear and worry about who we're going to call. But the thing is, like Makia was trying to explain, our reliance on police first actually cuts out a high percentage of people and actually makes all of us less safe. So by refocusing our efforts so that policing, maybe there is a role for them, but they are the last resort, not the first resort. So that there are organizations that are coming up with shoestring budgets, but they are doing incredible work, like the DC Safety Squad, mutual aid organizations all across the district, the Trigger Project, working with young people who are at very high risk of becoming shooters or maybe have already become shooters, right? But thinking about how do we invest, like Mikio was saying, in the people who are already doing this work. And so, one, you have fewer calls for those kinds of incidents. But two, there's sort of a phone tree, essentially. There are options, right? Because often what's happening is that we're given a hypothetical or a situation where it's police or nothing. Mm-hmm. But that's not what we're saying. One, it's already not police or nothing because there are already, like I said, the organizations that I mentioned, not to mention violence interrupters all over the city that could absolutely scale up if given the funds. There are crisis intervention workers that could scale up, right? But the city is actually funding all of these other organizations at not even a fraction of the budget that they're spending on policing and carceral responses. Yes. So in a practical way, there are absolutely steps that we can take to get there. It's not going to be today there are police, tomorrow there are no police. Right. Absolutely not. But actually right now, police spend over 90% of their time on nonviolent calls and on nonviolent, right, calls for service or anything like that. They're spending time doing things that civilians could be doing, right, that don't require somebody with a badge and a gun and the authority to detain you, to use force, to deprive you of your liberty, to deprive you of your life, right? That should be the last resort, not the first.
Yeah. And we've had this discussion. This isn't a new discussion. Mm-hmm. This discussion has been going on for a long time. We know that what police officers do, about 85 to 90% of it has nothing to do with the crime. But they are called because they're the first thing on the dial to call. What we need to do is equally invest in those other areas that also carry the burden of the kind of things that happen in our community. The violence interrupters, the credible messengers, they're doing a hell of a job out there. And it, what it does is when we reimagine what it is and the role that police play in our community, but then assign the other agencies of government to be involved in the process, we need to fund them at the same level that I would venture to say that the highest cut of pie in the district's budget is police.
Yeah. But when you talk and you would say that in most cities, but please
that's
go
exactly right
ahead. Right. Yeah.
Oh, no, you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
But if the problem is related to social services, if the problem is related to mental health, if it's related to working with youth, if it's related to families, then why aren't we investing at that level? And and do we have to sometimes look at whether or not the police function is an effective function in relationship to what it is that we want done in that particular community? And I can tell you the answer to the problem is that police, for example, shouldn't be responding to calls for mental health. I don't believe that they ought to be responding to calls for domestic violence. We have agencies, people who go to school for years and train to work in those areas, and we ought to utilize those folks in our community.
That could be a whole hour's conversation because, as you know, as a police officer, next to traffic stops, domestic violence calls are some of the most dangerous.
Oh, yes. Oh, it is. And if it was not for, I believe that policing had helped create the danger that was associated with it. Because that's one of the reasons why the lack of police response created the whole idea of what we have now, this mandatory arrest problem, was because that when we called the police, they didn't do anything. So now when you call the police, there's a mandatory arrest policy that's associated with domestic violence, when if they had referred and done what they should have done before a mandatory arrest, we wouldn't be looking at this problem in the way that we're looking at it now. So in some sense, they created the problem that they had to exist, and still locking the person up that's involved in the domestic violence is not there. Their organization, for example, in our city, that's much more effective with dealing with domestic violence.
And I'm not talking about locking them up, but I'm saying, you know, as we know, you know, when you talk about the domestic violence issue, if, you know, let's say, you know, the most common situation where you have the man who was the perpetrator of the domestic violence, mm-hmm. and you don't know what he may have. And I'm talking mm-hmm. about, you know, putting her in immediate danger, you know. But that's just something that I throw out there. The only other thing, McKee, I'd like for you to respond to this. I think when we talk about self-policing our neighborhood, and again, on the surface, that, you know, that is great, but I'm very, very concerned also about the possibility of a George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin situation, when you have people who are self-policing their, you know, their neighborhoods. If you live in an all-black neighborhood, or whether you live in a diverse neighborhood, you know, Makia, I don't think there are any perfect answers.
Right. I mean, I think at the end of the day, we know, I mean, for me, when, you know, things like that have happened in my home
yeah.
or in my neighborhood, I called my neighbor. I called Mr. Rob. I did not call the police. I called the person who knew me, the people who are closest to me. And I think that's what people more usually do, what they try to do, because they've seen time and time again what happens when we involve the police. And I completely agree. We do not want folks going out and using the same type of, you know, white supremacist mentality around black young people, like you saw with George Zimmerman. The thing about it is that white supremacy is so pervasive. It can exist even when white people are not around. It is the same mentality that leads us to harming one another, to believe that our community doesn't deserve better, that our people don't deserve better. But they also recognize that the city responds differently to the pain of black people than it does to other folks, and specifically people who are living in low-income neighborhoods. So folks understand that, you know, harming someone who comes from a marginalized group you're not going to get the same response. And so for folks that are like, what are we going to do around policing and so forth, they may want to start in their own homes and in their own families and look at, how are you protecting marginalized people in your family? How are people in your block being protected? What are the resources that we have? Am I connected with organizing, with a body of people who are trying to imagine a new way to be? Because I feel like that's the first step for anyone.
Speaking of protecting black people, as I'm sitting here watching this video from the poll cams that are there, I think the thing that is equally as disturbing as the actual beating, and while Ron has been speaking, when Nikia was speaking before Ron, and just now when Nike, thank you, I'm sorry, and Makia was speaking also, during that time, I'm watching this video, and Tyree Nichols is handcuffed, lying on his right side, hands behind him. And the thing that comes to mind is, where is the ambulance? Mm-hmm. Where's the ambulance? The officers are there. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I think there may be a sixth officer there. There's no ambulance.
Did they call?
I don't know.
So if I remember correctly, I believe the responders also may be facing discipline in this particular case.
Yeah, because they've been fired as well.
Right.
But I don't see the ambulance at all.
Right. So I think that speaks to, again, right, the lack of value that black people are experiencing, right, the dehumanization, because it's not just the initial harm and the violence, right? It's also the failure to intervene, like you mentioned, but it's also the failure to render aid, and we've seen that a lot. We've seen it in, we saw it in Colorado with Elijah McClain, right? After the carotid hold, the EMTs who administered a sedative that ended up killing him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you're seeing it not just in policing, and that's why we say that the state should not be the first response. The state should not be, in all of its forms, right, should not be the first go-to. Especially, and we also are not saying, when we say that the community should be the first responder, we're not, I am not suggesting self-policing, because I think even that term is problematic.
Yeah,
we're not talking about self-policing, because then that leads to things like vigilantism, like the person who took Karan Blake's life earlier this month, right? A 13-year-old child,
yeah.
And this person left their home armed and shot him. Right. Again, that speaks to the devaluation of black people's lives, regardless of age.
I just hope all of you in studio with me requested that you not see the video. And I try to respect that, you know, that mental health piece. And certainly in this position, as difficult as it is for me to watch, it's something that I must do. I must study. But I hope that I was respectful in sharing.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I want to thank all of you. Nike Savane, Ron Hampton, Makia Green. Thank you so much for participating in this conversation and the work that you are doing. We will continue to watch this issue.
Thank you.
That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Friday, January 27th. For News Director Renee Nash, reporters Millette Green, Bramante Bryant, producer Candace Wilson, and engineer Bobby Adams, I'm Harold Fisher. Good night and have a safe and peaceful weekend.